Unknown Californian writes in with $3. Frody, what would Odin do about the Jews?
Well, answering that question would be Fed posting, so I better not.
What would Odin do? Yeah. Okay. I think he would have a wise solution. He gave up an eye, he hung on a tree. He was seeking wisdom. I think he would be an ethno-nationalist. He would do the wise thing and be an ethno-nationalist. That's at least that's my story, and I'm going to stick with that.
Yeah.
Wise spelled W-I-S-E.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So Tarr, T-A-R-R, which is the title of a great novel by Wyndham Lewis, writes in with 10 AUD, Australian dollars. Thank you very much. Dr. Johnson, I am a currently paid member of CC. I must respectfully disagree with your position on our movement receiving vaccines, as there are many reasons why some may not accept. Can I please request a convo between yourself and Jay Dyer on this issue, philosophy and the transcendental argument, which Dyer subscribes? Thank you. If you want to put me in touch, or Frody's been in touch with Jay Dyer, maybe Frody, you can put me in touch with Jay Dyer. I'd have a conversation about it. I just made a very simple argument about this. Nick Fuentes, who's a bright guy and does a lot of good things, tweeted out he will never get a vaccination for COVID. Well, Nick's awfully young and he's probably in very little danger of dying from COVID. But my response was, Nick, you know, you're not going to be able to influence politics if you marginalize yourself from society. And the anti-vax position, taking a principled stand on this and foregoing it, that's a kind of self-marginalizing thing. He's already been put on a no-fly list. He doesn't need any more self-imposed reasons why he can't interact with people, that he can't get out there and move and shake, and he needs to move and shake. So I just made the argument, and Gaddius actually commented on this on his Telegram channel, and he added a little bit of precision that I think is good. If you're a mover and shaker and you need to travel and you need access to other people, you need not to self-marginalize. And one of the ways that people are proposing to self-marginalize is just not immunize themselves. So yeah, I made a simple argument about that. And yeah, I'm signing up. I'm going to get immunized. I'm not worried about it. I don't think it has microchips. I don't think it's going to kill me. I don't think it's going to make me sterile. You know, I'm not worried about it. Vaccines are very, very old medical treatments, and I'm not worried about the MNRI versions. And frankly, though, if I were worried about it, I'd just get the Sputnik. But anyway, I will definitely reach out to Jay Dyer and see what he has to say about it. So thank you, Tarr. Ian writes in with $65. Thank you very much, Ian. We will get your book out to you. Jasper writes in with $20. I recently started listening to neo-folk music, and in particular a band called Rome. It has a great sound with strong pro-European and traditionalist themes. Do you have an opinion on the genre or specific band recommendations? Frody, you've got some thoughts on Rome. Do you want to take this question first?
Sure, I can do that. Neo-folk is an interesting genre in that it is, I would say, implicitly right-wing and inherently right-wing, because it tends to be about our history. It tends to be, well, it's in the title of the genre, it's folk-inspired. And often it sort of encompasses other genres as well, sort of industrial music. But people just call it, the sort of generic term is usually neo-folk. And yes, I think it's an inherently right-wing type of music, because it is a sort of a sentimental, it tends to be sentimental about our past. It tends to be sentimental about our cultural, mythological, religious history. It tends to be, it can be heroic. It can be, it's a celebration of our roots inherently. So, I mean, it's inherently and implicitly right-wing in that way, right? And the issue, though, is that many or some of these bands, they have made explicit comments about their own personal politics, and they call themselves leftists, and they adhere to all the usual political correctness that you're expected to observe, right? And yeah, they do that. I have my own thoughts about how credible that is. But I do think it's interesting. And this isn't just in music. When you have to convey some sort of heroism, make something appealing, you have to use right-wing tropes. You have to use implicitly right-wing ideas and sensibilities, because left-wing ideas and sensibilities aren't very attractive. So they have to use that anyway. And when it comes to music, I don't really give a damn about what the particular musician or artist thinks about politics. Most musicians that I know about are idiots. I mean, most famous musicians. And that tends to be sort of like people with, they are blind or deaf, and that gives them heightened capabilities in other areas. And I think that is the same thing with people who are very skilled in one area. They tend to be very impractical in other areas, and they tend to not understand politics very well. So I think they have a generally just an aesthetic understanding of things, and that aesthetic happens to be implicitly right-wing. I think the most left-wing music that I can think of, and I actually had a conversation with Ty E about this yesterday when we had our AMA together on Guide to Culture, and I said that probably the most left-wing music I can think of is sort of cosmopolitan lounge music, where, you know, people sit in big cities, listen to soul-less music, drinking drinks in some sort of lounge, in a hotel lounge somewhere, and it has no ethnic soul at all. But that isn't neofolk, and Rome is one of those examples. That guy, he's from Belgium, Luxembourg, or something like that, I think. Jerome something, the guy who's behind that music project. And I've seen Rome live. I think it's an okay music project. I think it's very sort of it's very poppy, and it's very it's the kind of neofolk that can reach the masses in a way. But I think it has some qualities, and I think it's good. I think there are other neofolk bands that are better. I love Changes. Changes is fantastic. I like Herr, the project that Troy Southgate actually is involved in, a British guy. I think there's some great stuff there, and I think there's a lot of interesting stuff that is involved in that genre. So yeah, I can recommend it, and I wouldn't be too worried about what this or that musician says about his politics, because chances are, that they're idiots about politics anyway.
Woz, do you have any thoughts on neofolk in general and Rome in particular?
No, it's not a genre that I'm terribly, well, I'm not familiar with that at all, really, and I've never heard of Rome. So I'm sorry, there's nothing I can say about that. But I would say about musicians and politics, it's nice if you know that the musician wouldn't hate you. And, yeah. It's nice, but it's not necessary. You can enjoy the thing separate from its creator, I think.
Yeah, I like neofolk. I've been listening to neofolk music for more than 20 years. My favorite neofolk act, I would have to say, is Death in June. They're one of the definers of the genre, and they still are putting out stuff. It's just one guy, basically, Douglas P. I like Der Blutarsch. I like the early Der Blutarsch. There are three Der Blutarsch versions. One is the early sort of martial industrial Der Blutarsch, which I think is excellent. Then it underwent a kind of krautrock metamorphosis or mutation. And the krautrock stuff is really good too. And now it's stoner rock. And I stopped collecting it a few years back. I stopped really following it a few years back. It just kind of got old. I like a lot of Current 93. A lot of the early stuff is truly fantastic. Fire and Ice has some good music. I've got boxes and boxes of neofolk stuff, and I love it. So if you want to explore more neofolk, some writing about it, go to Countercurrents and just type in neofolk, because I've written a few things about Death in June. And Scott Weiswald has written about Death in June. He's written about, I think he's written about Rome. He's written about Current 93. There's a lot of actually good writing about neofolk at Countercurrents. It's a very important genre. another group that sort of isn't neo-folk, but it overlaps a little bit with the political symbolism is Laibach. I'm a huge Laibach fan. I'm crazy about Laibach, and they're still active. And there are a few things on Laibach at Countercurrents as well. So yeah, it's a good question. Thank you. I think we've got some good answers to that.
Oh, can I just say that I've been informed that there a musician called Darkest Sky, who I really like, is an English guy. Apparently he fits the neo-folk genre. So, and I really like his stuff. He doesn't seem to be active anymore, which is a real shame because his music was fantastic, I thought. That's Darkest Sky, everyone.
Good. Is he available on YouTube, for instance?
He should be. He got banned. I don't know what the situation is, but people, I'm sure, will be able to find Darkest Sky on BitChute, for example. I'm sure he's there.
Okay, great. So Sunshine Kid writes in with $15. Greg, in your TED Talk with Rich Hauck, you talked at about 127.40 about a different wave of modernity that could have been. Could you expound on that for a bit? Are you talking about interwar fascism or specific thinkers like Vico or later thinkers like Ludovici and Guillaume Fay? Well, basically what I said is this. Okay, the early form of modern philosophy and modern liberalism and modern social thinking really emphasized founding everything on desire, on satisfying basic human needs. The trouble with that is that it undermines culture, it undermines identity, it undermines society, really. And you can't really create a political order or understand political order or preserve existing political orders if everything is just about satisfying your selfish interests in a marketplace. And so a second wave of modernity came along that was basically critical of this first wave. And it emphasized that human beings are a little more complicated than just clever animals trying to maximize their utility through trade or plunder. And that second wave included figures like Vico. It included people like Rousseau. You really see inklings of this in Adam Smith's theory of moral sentiments, in Kant and the German idealists. And they attempt to found modernity and justify modernity in some sense, based on the cultivation of man's moral faculties, not just the satisfaction of our desires, but the cultivation of our moral nature. And that civilization, for Rousseau, which can't be really justified based just on satisfying your individual needs, can be justified in terms of cultivating our spiritual side, that we're more complicated than just clever animals. And that's why we create civilizations, we create particular cultures, we create high culture and high art and so forth, none of which makes any sense if you just take a really materialist view of mankind. So that's it in a nutshell. Elizabeth writes in with $50. That's very generous. Thank you. Recently, Woese commented on being in Sweden and about his Uber driver and Swedish women. What do Woese and Frody think of race mixing, and is it big in Europe, and how can we stop it? So, Woese, can you fill us in on this story and give us your thoughts about race mixing in Europe?
God, that was a video that I published on Odyssey a few months ago, but it was from 2017. It was from February 2017 when I was in Stockholm. It was my first time in Sweden, and I was there for a conference. It was just after I'd been doxxed, and I had an experience where this taxi driver or Uber driver, I can't remember now, and he was obviously not white, not Nordic, not Swedish, not European. And he said something to me like, I asked him, where are you from? And he said, well, originally Turkish, but I'm Swedish. And then he laughed. And then he said something about, like, do you like Sweden? We've got nice girls here. And the video that I made at the airport, it was only 3 or 4 minutes long, and it was just to make a point, which you would never make on YouTube nowadays, which was that these two statements from the guy seemed to contradict themselves, because he was saying that he was Swedish, but then saying, we have nice girls here. But obviously he wasn't referring to other Turkish Swedish. He wasn't referring to Turkish Swedish girls when he said that we've got nice girls in Sweden. He was referring to native Swedish girls, young, you know, blonde, blue-eyed women. And so I thought it sort of gave the game away that not necessarily the only reason he's there, but at any rate, when he sells his country, it's on the basis of the beauty of the native women, not of his ethnic group's women. I thought that was interesting. And of course, he obviously covets these native women in some sense. Perhaps he approaches them, perhaps he beds them, who knows. But that was the point. And I called it civic syndrome because I was, as a play on Stockholm syndrome, because I was making the point that this is what civic nationalism really leads to. It's a guy coveting native Swedish women while knowingly not being Swedish himself, but also calling them his own because he's saying, we've got nice girls here in Sweden, and I'm Swedish, whilst knowing that he's really Turkish. So it was just sort of a video very quickly, briefly giving the lie to civic nationalism.
Frody, do you have any thoughts on this?
I can definitely recognize that attitude is probably very common among immigrants in Sweden. And yes, it happens, and it's very unfortunate. What I think about race mixing, I think people should have children with other people like themselves. I think, you know, that people should try to stay to their own and not only within the same major race. I think ethnic differences are also very important, and I think people should try to preserve those as well when it comes to, you know, creating the next generation. I think that's very important. And I think there are many, many reasons for that. Maybe we shouldn't get into all of the reasons why that is important. I think it's very obvious, and especially since this is a nationalist podcast, I think it's obvious that we probably are opposed to race mixing. It happens, and I don't know how much it happens. I've seen these polls or these surveys that would claim that white women are the most racially loyal demographic. And I think that is, I don't know how reliable that is. I think they've done that on dating sites, for example, that when you have black men, black women, Asian men, Asian women, white men, white women, and which of those are most likely to accept dates or go on dates with people of their own race and less likely to date outside of their race. And apparently, according to those polls, white women are the least likely to date outside of their race. Now, like I said, I don't know how reliable those surveys are, but that's what they say. And I do think that maybe I'm being somewhat, you know, hopeful, or maybe this is wishful thinking, that maybe stupid white women will date Arabs or migrants when they're young and hopefully have kids with people of their own kind, of their own race, when they're older, when they settle down. I think that is probably best case scenario, because I'm aware, I mean, just from seeing what goes on in the cities and around me, I can see that people are dating across racial lines. But I do think that the actual mixing, the actual having kids together, I think that is less common than our worst fears, at least, would suggest. I think that probably a lot of the race mixing that happens is, you know, some casual dating or whatever, and that is made popular by TV and by the mass media. We all know that. But hopefully, and I think so, that when people actually settle down and have kids, it's most likely with people of their own race and of their own kind, of their own people. So yeah, I do think it's a problem. I do think it's a, you know, it breaks my heart to see it, and it breaks my heart to see, you know, white women, beautiful white women, having kids with someone outside of their race. It's crazy. What can we do about it was the question. And well, the only thing we can do about it is to create a society or a community, at least, where our daughters grow up with better values and better role models and better standards. I mean, our standards now are set by a hostile media that is explicitly out to destroy us. So, of course, they will encourage our people to date outside of our race and to have kids outside of our race. So, of course, they would do that. But the only thing we can do is to, you know, get away from that hostile society and create our own communities and probably, hopefully, give our own kids some values that would encourage them to have kids with their own kind.
Yeah, I think miscegenation laws exist in multiracial societies for a reason. I think the best anti-miscegenation laws, though, really are just borders. And once Europe takes control of its own borders and European nations take control of their own borders and start repatriating all these recent migrants, that is going to put an end to a great deal of race mixing, which is a good thing. You know, in the past, when the white population was expanding and whites were exploring and putting down roots and coming into contact with people of other races on the frontiers, a bit of race mixing took place, but it didn't threaten the race because the core population was constantly growing. And it was easy to imagine that such occasional crossings would just sort of be diluted and disappear. But we have a shrinking race. Our race is getting smaller with each passing year. We can't afford this nonsense anymore. Instead of absorbing a bit of extraneous DNA on the frontiers, we are now in danger of just being submerged and disappearing off the planet. So we have to have a very different attitude towards it today. We can't be kind of laissez-faire about it and, oh, boys will be boys and it's only in the Americas and that kind of stuff. It's right in Europe. It's right in our racial heartland. And it has to be reversed. And the best thing to do is just to have borders again and then commence repatriation to these outside groups that just don't belong in Europe. They have homelands that they belong in. So I want to go to another question on entropy. Man of the North writes in with $15, and this is a question for Woes. Woes, any glimmers of hope from the recent UK elections? Are normies realizing the London election was mostly a racial headcount? Are the Tories' proposed immigration restrictions and voter ID laws a reason for hope or just a release valve gesture? What are your thoughts?
I'm afraid that I have no positive things to say about this. The SNP did very well in Scotland, even with their recent corruption. So, no, I don't think it went well. Same thing in England, same thing in London. People are not waking up yet, I'm afraid. I wish I could tell you otherwise, but no. The machine is too powerful at changing their minds.
Okay, well, that's a very, very concise answer. Thank you. I noticed in the chat, Unknown Californian asked me if I had Crom in my life. This is very funny. Somebody shared a picture from the 1960s of some anti-war protester holding up a sign that said, "Kill a commie for Crom," which I thought was hilarious. And it's apropos because today I just sent in a review of Conan the Barbarian, the 1982 John Milius movie, to the UNS Review. So that should be up this coming week at the UNS Review. And a few days later, 2 days after that, it'll be at Countercurrents. Of course, Crom was Conan's god. So there was a bit of Crom in my life. And this is funny. It fits in with a question that Sutton sent in, which is a variation on something from last week. And I'll just ask everybody, guys, what was the last song you listened to, the last movie you watched, and the last meal you had before this podcast? So I'll go first. The last song was Pink Floyd's Echoes. The last movie was Conan the Barbarian. And the last meal I had was a kind of cassoulet that I made up for my my lunch. So anyway, Frody, what was your last song, last movie, and last meal to answer Sutton's question?
All right. Oh, boy. Well, I've been, these last few days, I've been recovering. I have the flu or the Rona, so I've just taken a break from my recovering to do this show, and then I'm going back to lay down on the sofa. So I ordered a pizza. I haven't been very active, so that's the meal I had. And the film, I just finished watching Natural Born Killers before we started this show. And the last song, I'm not completely sure, probably something by Blackmagic SS. I'm not really sure which song I would have listened to last, but something like that.
What about you, Woz?
Oh, the last song was probably Money for Nothing by Dire Straits, which I've been listening to an awful lot recently. I really like it, the full version, the album version. The last film was Still With Nell and I from a few weeks ago, I'm afraid. I really don't watch films. And the last meal was oven chips. That was it.
You were doing polls about chips today, so
I wondered
about that.
Yeah, that was why. Yeah. Well, actually, they weren't me though. They were a friend of mine, so I forwarded them on. This is all on Telegram, by the way.
Right.
So yes, yeah, but that was why.
So Unknown Californian writes in with $5 and says, Greg, would you be a guest on the McLaughlin Group? Would that show be one you would like to host? You know, I'd go on practically any show. I'd love to go on Tucker Carlson Tonight sometime. One of these days, these things will happen, right? There's, of course, huge barriers to us now. But as the current system falls apart, and the barriers become more porous, many things will be possible. And one of the things that I would love is to actually start getting invitations to debate people who are more mainstream, and invitations to go on podcasts and TV shows and live streams and things like that with more mainstream people. That will happen. So it's just a matter of time. As the system breaks down, its control of people's minds and control of the narrative, control of the media will destabilize, and more people will be looking for alternatives, and more people will be willing to hear us. So I'll be ready. We got a question from Eric here. What do you consider to be the most beautiful spoken language? And I'm also going to add, what do you consider to be the ugliest spoken language? So my thoughts on this are pretty simple. I like Italian as a spoken language. I like the music of the Italian language. I like the music of the French language. I think that's a very attractive language as well. But for me, the English language is the most beautiful language because it's my native tongue. And if it's spoken with a pleasing accent, it can just be absolute music to my ears. The ugliest spoken language to my ears is Chinese. It just drives me nuts to hear it for any length of time. So, Woz, what are your thoughts? What's your favorite spoken language and your least favorite spoken language?
My favorite would probably be German, just because it even sounds intelligent. It sounds sophisticated, and I that appeals to me. I like that it sounds intelligent. That's you know, just as someone who doesn't understand the vast majority of German, that's how it sounds, the sort of timbre that it has. Least favorite would probably be something like Hindi, something like that, where it just sounds like a bunch of squibbles and squabbles. I really hate that.
Frody?
That's a difficult question. I don't know. I mean, either my favorite languages are probably I mean, I love the Icelandic sagas, and there's just a hyper masculinity about them. So either that, or something like French, because it's and for two very different reasons. Of course, Icelandic for hyper masculinity and that the sound, the sort of harsh masculine sound, and French for the sort of the arrogant, decadent, the way they express themselves in literature. And I don't speak French fluently at all. I hardly understand anything of French, but I love French literature and translation, and just the style they have and the way they have of thinking is charming, charismatic. When it comes to the ugliest languages, I mean, something Middle Eastern, Hebrew or Arabic or something with the sort of gutturals, those kinds of sort of disgusting sounds, it's just unbearable to listen to.
Okay, that is great. And so another question from Eric, what do you consider to be your greatest achievement? I think that's a really interesting question, and I've been thinking about this for a few minutes. The thing that I'm most proud of, frankly, is the White Nationalist Manifesto. And I don't think it's the best thing that I've done in the sense it's the best written thing or the best argued thing, but it's the best thing that I could do to make that case for ethno-nationalism. And I'm very proud of it. I was looking at it again recently and I thought, you know, this stands up. This is good. A new edition has come out in French, which makes me very, very proud. I'm waiting for a copy of that to show up in the mail. There is a translation into Italian and a translation into Portuguese that I'm sitting on. I've just been behind in getting them out, but I'm going to be getting them out probably by June or July. So those long suffering translators will see their work in print. I know that there are other translations in the works. There was a Dutch one. I don't know what the status of that. A Ukrainian one. I'm not sure about the status of that. A German one is sort of broken down, and we're thinking of trying to find ways of reviving it. So yeah, I'm rather proud of that that book. But I think the best thing that I've done overall is just creating countercurrents. I think countercurrents is something I'm very proud of. So countercurrents would include all of my books and all the other books published by our authors and the webzine as well. I'm very, very proud of countercurrents. Frody, what's your greatest achievement?
There's obviously a difference between, you know, my private life and what I do in public. And I guess that, of course, I'll focus here on what I do in public and with my metapolitical involvement. And what I'm proud of is having been able to, under very difficult circumstances, of course, with the help from some great people, being able to bring people together for real life events under a lot of pressure and a lot of hostility from all kinds of camps, a lot of hostility, and still being able to bring a lot of people together and hopefully helped, you know, change their life in some way by giving them an opportunity to meet others and to network and to move their involvement in a more productive or constructive direction. Because I think that's really where a lot of the solution to our problems is, to get people out there and to get people out of their comfort zones. And a lot of people have come up to me and contacted me afterwards and said that, you know, they came to my event and that is the first thing that they ever did, you know, outside of theoretical reality online. So they actually got out there, met people, and started becoming involved in different ways, either starting a project or just becoming friends, networking with other people, and that became a big part of their life. And others have also told me that they became inspired by those events that I've created to create their own events, and then in turn sort of replicate that success elsewhere and to continue doing that. But I will say that I do think that my greatest achievements are still ahead of me in that part of my life. So I do think that there are great things to come as well.
Wonderful. Woz, what is your greatest achievement?
The Withnell speech that I gave in 2017, possibly the Hope Not Hate speech that I gave in 2019 at Frode's Skansa conference in Stockholm, and Millennial as a tradition. I think those would be my three things. There are one or two other videos that I'm very, very proud of from my catalogue. But those are the three that spring to mind.
By the way, I was going to ask you today, before we started the show, would you mind if I got that Withnell and I speech of yours transcribed?
No, not at all.
Okay. I have a transcriptionist who's just pawing at the ground for another project, and I thought, I'd love to have a text of the Withnell and I speech. I think that would be a great thing to have out there. Well, I'll get that going then. That's good. Gaelic Nord in the comments at Countercurrents writes, is multiracialism not already illegal given what's stated in the legal definition of genocide? Thoughts about this, folks? Well, he's referring to the UN's Convention on Genocide, which defines genocide not just as the outright, fast, hot killing off of a population, but also creating conditions that make it impossible for it to reproduce itself, to maintain its identity. Yeah, absolutely. This is something that's very important. This is something that came out of the bugs people, white rabbit people, Bob Whitaker people, emphasizing that diversity is white genocide by the definitions of the UN. I think that's an extremely powerful point. I've incorporated it into my own writing, into my manifesto. We are being targeted for a slow, stealth genocide, a kind of cold genocide. And currently, if we don't change the trends, white people will go extinct. That's just the fact. We've got to change that. We've got to turn it around. And the best way to turn it around is to gain control over our homelands, gain control over our borders, and institute pronatal policies within every white homeland. That's the only way that there are going to be white people on the planet a couple hundred years hence, if we turn these negative trends around. And since these trends are being engineered and promoted, it's conscious. It's not just an accident, right? It's a conscious policy. And therefore, it's genocide. It's not an accident. It's not a ghastly mistake. There are people who promote conditions in white countries that they would never promote in their ethnostate in the Middle East. Why? Because they know what genocide is, and they're quite comfortable imposing those conditions on other people. It's an intolerable situation, and it's got to change, and it will change. That's the goal of my life. That's my project. So let me take a quick look over back at Eric's questions. He sent a few. What would you consider the most overrated virtue? That's really an interesting question. What virtue is overrated, or what alleged virtue is not really a virtue at all? I think that tolerance, open-mindedness, liberal-mindedness, and so forth, these tend to be overrated virtues. How to put it? Well, I would put it this way. Any virtue that makes you less capable as an individual or as a group to survive is definitely overrated. So, for instance, there are certain virtues that are good within a group. In-group altruism is a virtue. Altruism to everybody that's not reciprocated is not just overrated, it's a vice. It's a deadly vice. So yeah, I would have to say that altruism towards everyone is definitely not a virtue, but it's propounded as a virtue. It's the most destructive fake virtue out there. Woz, do you have any thoughts on what the most overrated virtue is?
Well, I think that this is a bit of a corny answer, but I think that the belief in equality, I think that that is now regarded as a virtue in itself, to be egalitarian, to believe in the equality of all cultures and sexes and races and everything, lifestyles. So if that is a virtue, then I would say it is the most overrated virtue, because it's completely insane and conducive towards disaster. So yeah, I would say that would be the most overrated virtue, if you regard it as a virtue.
Well, I do think it's regarded as a virtue. It's preached. You must be blind, colorblind. You know, since when is blindness ever a virtue? It's only a virtue to people who are up to stuff that they don't want you to see. Frody, what are your thoughts about overrated virtues?
Well, Aristotle had this idea about virtues that, you know, that you have to have a balanced amount of them, and when you have too much of them, it's bad, and too little of something, it's also bad. And I think what we have too much of, or emphasize too much today, is in a way reason or rationality. Especially white people, we overestimate the ability and our own ability to reason with other people, to reach other people on a rational level, and we overestimate our ability, or we overestimate the extent to which other people are rational, and that just makes it so that we misunderstand how the world works, and we misunderstand political conflicts, because political conflicts aren't really polite bourgeois discussions where you produce evidence, logical arguments, etc. And I think that has really been the downfall. That has been at the core of the downfall of the right, the post-war right. That is why the conservative right has been completely impotent and a complete failure, because they think that, oh, everyone is just a nice fellow, and they just want to think, they want to do what they think is right. And if I just present the right argument to them, then they will, you know, come to their senses. That is just a complete insanity. And I think it is a huge roadblock for success. The overemphasis on rationality and reason, because at the end of the day, people aren't 100% rational. And even the most rational people aren't rational all of the time. So I think our understanding of people as these rational calculating machines has really limited our ability to do good in the world.
Could I add something to that?
Absolutely.
I think that's a really good point. And it's embodied, right? First of all, you said that it blinds us to how other peoples operate. I think it also blinds us to how we ourselves operate, because, you know, we liked, and this is a thing that I've said again and again, that people should try to know themselves. People like to think that they're rational and that's all that really matters to them. That's all that motivates them. But that's a complete delusion. And I think that when we think, well, I'm just being rational, we are misunderstanding our own motivations in almost any situation, but especially when it comes to the salient issues of our time. So that's one thing. But the other thing I wanted to say was that what you say about reason and logic and evidence being less important and insufficient tools for debating and getting your way in the world, that is embodied in the figure of Stefan Molyneux. He preaches reason, logic, and evidence constant. And this is not an attack on him, by the way. I am a fan of him. I actually quite like his stuff. But he preaches reason, logic, and evidence all the time. And yet he was taken down by a power that didn't care about reason, logic, and evidence and wasn't listening to him as he preached that. And he can't use reason, logic, and evidence against that power or to persuade that power to give him what he wants, which, first of all, means that he is not motivated entirely by reason, logic, and evidence. He has biases. He wants something that other peoples in the world don't want. He's selfish. He's self-motivated. But it also means that reason, logic, and evidence will not work against in and of themselves. They're simply insufficient as weapons of debating and persuasion. So I think that it's just interesting that he, for me, really embodies this crisis. It should be a crisis, really. I don't think it is, because most people implicitly accept what I'm saying anyway, that reason, logic, and evidence is it's an intellectual's game. But to think that everyone is like that, and some people do, like Molyneux, it is to set yourself up for disaster.
Yeah, absolutely. The problem, or the paradoxical thing about rationality, is that when you are too rational and when you place too great an emphasis on rationality, that becomes irrational, because you go against the evidence that you actually observe in the behaviors of others, that you stubbornly hold on to your belief in rationality when the entire world shows you, all the evidence shows you that the world isn't rational, that other people aren't rational. It's sort of like, if we just have the perfect social contract, the black people will behave because that's what the contract says. These people are idiots and they're irrational at the end of the day, but their ideology is based on an overemphasis on rationality.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. We have another question here, and this is actually kind of a big question. It just came in from Lovecraft's Cat. Is there hope for America? Well, that's a great, big, gloomy question to end this conversation with, and I expect it'll be the last question we can get to. Is there hope for America? Yes and no. I think there's definitely hope for white people on the North American continent. There are tens and tens of millions of us. We're not going to just disappear because some people want us to. Right now, what is preventing us from saving ourselves as a race is hope that we can save ourselves within the current political system that exists in the United States and Canada. I think that it's increasingly clear that we can't save ourselves within the existing political system in the United States or Canada, especially the United States. Why? Well, because right now we have problems that cannot be solved within the essentially liberal paradigm that the United States runs on. We have, for instance, a media and an academia and now a federal government that have basically been taken over by what you can call just a religious cult, the cult of woke. And of course, major corporations run on this cult as well. When you see officials in the United States government running through these mantras, I acknowledge that I exist on the property of the Mugwug Indians, and I acknowledge their plant-based wisdom, and my pronouns are she, he, or she, her, or whatever. It's astonishing. These are serious people with educations in positions of responsibility in our government, and they're talking like this, or this ridiculous video of this intersectional brown person who's proud and she's taken her head, screwed it on straight, and no man's going to tell her that it ain't, and she's working for the CIA. It's just chilling. Our country's been taken over by a religious cult, basically. And the religious cult has three branches, really, in my opinion. One is just the anti-white BLM stuff. Another aspect of it is basically Antifa. And a third aspect of it is the tranny cult, and they overlap, they reinforce one another, and they're basically a kind of mafia / religious cult that is moving in and taking over America's leading institutions. Well, I don't see any way that these people can just be voted out of office. For one thing, we don't vote who owns the media. We don't vote who runs academia. I can't imagine. Okay, America is going to have another summer of racial unrest as soon as a black criminal has a bad encounter with the cops, and there's never any shortage of black criminals, and the cops are not going to completely avoid confrontations with blacks, although they're doing their best to avoid it, which is why crime is going through the roof. There will be a bad encounter of a black criminal with the police or with an armed homeowner, something like that. And there will be the same script run. This is racism, even though race probably played no role in it. This is systematic anti-white racism, even if it's George Zimmerman who pulled the trigger, and on and on. Truth doesn't matter anymore. These people tell lies and cities burn and people die. And this process will go on and on and on until the people who are doing it are ejected from their positions of power and influence. There is no provision within the government of the law, the existing constitution and laws of the United States that I know of, that would allow you to purge the leading institutions of society of basically a religious cult or of mafia, except maybe criminal conspiracy laws, right? Because these people are involved in a criminal conspiracy. That is definitely true. But here, the great question is, who would do this? The Republicans? Are you kidding me? America is in a terrible situation where, in order to survive as a nation, there has to be a massive purge of the government, of academia, and of the media. Those three power centers have to be purged of this cult that is basically egging the society on to perdition. And I don't see any provisions within the current laws that would do that, except maybe conspiracy. I mean, that's definitely a direction to explore. But the bigger question is, who has the guts to do it? Who has the organization to do it? Are there five serious men in America who would do this? And so I'm thinking, not within the current system is America going to be saved. There's going to have to be thinking outside the box. And who's going to do that? Well, it's not anybody who is a visible member of America's political elite, which is basically divided now into a religious cult filled with passionate intensity, driving the country into ruin, and a bunch of cowardly conservatives who lack the conviction to stand in their way. So we're going to have to think way outside the current establishment and the current legal framework, I think, if America is to be saved. But I have no doubt that white people in North America, in Canada, in the United States, even in Mexico, have a future on this continent. I'm just not sure how it's going to be done within the existing frameworks, political frameworks that we have today. Woz, do you have any thoughts on this? You've been to America. Do you think there's any hope for America?
Oh, I'm not the one to ask this or to answer this. I think it's a very different scenario from Europe, from Britain. I mean, there is more freedom. There is still freedom of speech there. There's still the First Amendment. There's still the Second Amendment. This changes everything. So, and you see that in the manner of articulation on respective sides of the Atlantic. But I don't know. I would suspect it will end up with secession, but I think that will require a breakdown of the federal government. That's the only future I would see for white Americans, is if that power is disintegrated. Because I think it has become a power that is wholly possessed by crazies and malefactors, let's say. So, yeah, I think as long as the America exists as a superpower and as the country that we've all known all our lives, so as long as that exists, it cannot heal itself. I think it has to break up. But that's just my outsider's perspective.
Okay, Frody, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, can America be saved? It sort of depends on what you mean by that. I'm very certain that you can't go back. You're not going to go back to the normal country that you had before all the chaos started. You're not going to go back to the 50s or 60s or even the 80s. This car has no brakes. It's collapsing. The collapse has started. It's collapsing already. So, in that sense, no, there is no hope for America. The collapse has already started. You're not going to turn it around. And just look at the videos, the commercial videos for the army and for the CIA with the trannies, with the lesbians, with the Latina first generation working for the CIA. And, you know, it's like you would think that an army and an intelligence agency would worry about their brand, right?
They worry about having intelligent people working there, you think?
Yeah, and I said this on the morning show that I do, Wake Up on the Right Side. I was talking about this issue. And, you know, America at least used to have the brand that their intelligence agency, their military and everything was scary because competent, because they had a lot of skilled people and very elite in a way. Now, a lot of people might say that wasn't true back then either, but they had that brand. Without a doubt, they had that brand and they were scary because of that to their opponents or whatever. But now they're scary for a different reason. Now they're scary as a schizophrenic homeless guy wielding a knife is scary. It's just completely batshit crazy, insane people running the show now, and they're unpredictable because of that, and they're incompetent. But that doesn't mean they can, you know, that doesn't mean that they can't lash out and attack people. So I think the collapse is scary, and it always is. So yeah, a collapse is coming, and a collapse is already here. I think it's silly to talk about it as a possible future when it's already here. The collapse is here. That doesn't mean that there is no future for white Americans. White Americans can still have a great future. It's just that it's not possible to go back. And I don't think that's unique for America. I think that goes for many European countries that are in very bad shape. I think the UK, Germany, France, I don't think you can go back to a normal situation after something like this. I don't think you can have a capital city where your people are already a minority and then just, well, let's just turn things around and in 5 years we'll be back to normal things and having, you know, the London of Sherlock Holmes back. No, that's not going to happen. You have the machete London now, right? Instead of Sherlock Holmes London. But that doesn't mean that all hope is lost for white people. But it means that we have to start thinking about other things rather than just what can we do to undo the damage. The damage can't be undone. So I just think that is a realization that people have to accept.
Yeah, I think that's very wise. Beavis and Butthurt has donated an ice cream. Beavis and Butthurt, 4 lemons. Bastard of Modernity, 1 lemon. So, folks, we basically run out of time. I think this has been a fun discussion. We almost had 500 at our peak. We're over 400 right now. This will show up in two parts, I hope. The first hour will be free tomorrow at Countercurrents, and the second hour will come up on Tuesday behind the paywall. In 2 weeks from today, we're going to have a special guest. We just set this up. We're going to have Jason Kessler on, and we're going to do a telethon for him because he needs to raise money for his lawsuit in the post-Charlottesville battle, and he's going to give us an update on the progress that he's made. There's a lot of really interesting stuff coming to light because Jason is stubbornly fighting this lawfare harassment that has been directed against by enormously well-funded, largely Jewish organizations, interestingly enough, who have been harassing people who participated in Unite the Right and trying to destroy them through lawfare. So he's been fighting that, and he's found a lot of really interesting information about it. So that'll be 2 weeks from today. And next week, we will be back with a normal show, another one of these panels, which I very much enjoy. So I want to thank my panelists. I want to thank Woz. I want to thank Frody. I want to thank our moderators. I want to thank the donors out there. And I want to thank all the listeners who are listening live and the people who will be listening in the future. Thank you very much for making this possible. And we will be back with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.